Okay, we're back. Welcome back, everyone. The brief delay, I had to restart the computer. Hope you all had a good weekend. A couple things to discuss before we dive into lecture today. First is the exam. So the midterm will begin after class today. Should already be posted to the website. It's password protected, and that password will come out as a Canvas announcement right at the end of lecture. I moved it back. It was originally due during the normal homework time. So now the assignment's due Friday by 5 o'clock, end of the day. The way this will work, midterm exam, have between the end of class and Friday, no collaboration is allowed with other students in the class, with other students outside of the class, or with anybody else. It has to be completely your own work as an exam. No web resources other than the course webpage. I don't want you going out and posting to Twitter, hey, can anybody solve this problem? Things like that. Okay. You can ask questions to me. Generally, I will not answer is this correct or how do you do this kind of questions. But if there is a theoretical question or just a understanding what the problem is asking for kind of question, I'm happy to answer them. Be careful if you post those in our course Slack, just so that you're not giving other people hints as to how you're doing things. You ask a question of, hey, I ran into this number being infinite, that might give others hints about how you're approaching the problem or if they're seeing similar things. If you want to post in that public Slack, make sure it's a generic question. If you ask, what do you mean when you say this? That's fine. If you ask, what does it mean when I get this kind of result? That could be giving others hints. So be careful there. Any questions on any of that? Anybody online? Sure my audio is right. Okay, another thing to discuss, given that it's an exam week, willing to drop a lecture if people think that would be helpful. So we could cancel Friday lecture if that helps people either have more time available to do the exam or just have a period of respite as the exam is ending. But since we have no breaks this semester, I want you all to get your money's worth, so I wanted to hear everybody's opinion. Would you like to drop Friday lecture, or would you like to just keep going? Either way, this week I'll just be covering additional course material beyond what's on the exam. Any opinions on that?
I think dropping Friday lecture would be nice, but I don't know. I don't know if I feel like too terribly strongly about it.
Jillian asks, would it be possible to use that time as office hours? Sure. Happy to do that. That's a bit late. I will try to be available all week if you have any questions. We haven't used it much lately, but you all are, as a reminder, welcome to any time during my posted office hours. Just tell me if you'd like me to hop in a Zoom and talk, and you're welcome to set up a video call through Slack or through Zoom any other time with some scheduling with me. Those are all options, but sure, I can stay available during that entire Friday lecture time to answer any questions. Okay. unless there are any dissenting opinions, we'll say, okay, no lecture on Friday. Just a bit of a break, if nothing else, but I'll be available as office hours during that time. Any other thoughts or questions before the exam goes live about functionally the exam or any other content you want to ask any questions about before the exam starts? Okay. Everybody's ready. Great. Exam's going to be 3 problems, dominantly state plan analysis, some topologies or applications that you may not have seen before, but the analysis approach is the same as what we've been doing. Nothing crazy in terms of when the rubber hits the road. One other thing before we dive in, I want to talk about this homework 7 solution. If you saw some of the discussion in the Slack, the solution I posted did have an error where I replaced M1 with M2. And that just being a minor error wouldn't be a big issue, except that I realized as I corrected it, it leads to a situation that would have been, I think, fair for me to ask of you if I hadn't led you astray. So what basically happened is I gave these figures on the assignment as exemplary waveforms. And with the incorrect use of M2, that all matches up, but gives a wrong answer. When that's replaced and it's M1, what happens is J1, which be like this thing here, depending on how you labeled it, becomes negative. So this is J1 here in the actual solution to the problem. This means the state plane is kind of, the interval has grown and it's rotated enough that that point drops below the M/R axis. And if you've handled everything generally, then it's no problem. The approach is all the same. But having J1 go less than 0 can generate some problems, and particularly if you're doing calculations where you're using in MATLAB like an ATAN of JX over MX, something like that, or pi minus the inverse of that. When that goes negative, depending on how you've set it up, it may cause problems, right? So if you use the either law of cosines, which we haven't really discussed in class, to solve for these angles, or just used ATAN2 in MATLAB with 2 arguments, so that as one of them goes negative, it creeps the angle in the correct quadrant, then it all works out fine and the solution's the same. But since we hadn't really talked about this, and since I showed waveforms that would kind of lead you astray, I'm going to call that an issue with the problem and go easy on the grading of this as long as you were doing the correct kind of things. Okay. Other than that, the solution proceeds all the same. Okay. So down here, I'm just showing what happens over here on the left if I just used ATAN and I try to solve for varying beta, varying phase shift, what is J, and then I'm also showing J1. So you'll see, as I did it in the solution where I set this up with a solver and use fsolve to solve it, I miss this portion of the curve. As soon as J1 hits 0, it can't solve it anymore. That's because that arc tangent gets in the wrong quadrant. Over here, if I use ATAN2 or just resolve everything using the law of cosines, then I get the full curve. It's able to solve it even as J1 goes down below 0. Keeps that angle in the correct polarity. There's also a post on the Slack that I didn't see until this morning. Somebody was asking, are there also 2 solutions? And there are. And that's going to be a general characteristic of everything except the maximum possible power in these phase-shifted AC link converters. But there is, much like the DAB, a kind of small phase shift and a large phase shift, both of which will lead to the same operating point. So you could, even without handling this arctangent issue, find this high phase shift operating point. But as I've said in lecture, we almost always want to stay over here because these higher phase shift operating points have, for example, here instead of having a J1 of about -1, it's got a J1 of about 15, implying, hey, there's a whole lot higher peak current and RMS current throughout this whole thing, which will lead to higher conduction losses. These are most often bad points to operate at. Occasionally, you may want to go out there to get that higher current for ZVS at light loads. But generally, we want to limit to less than a phase shift of about pi over 2. Depending on the exact topology, it'll be a little bit off from pi over 2 where that peak power point is. But we want to kind of limit in this lower conduction loss region. So you may have been able to find this one, even if you didn't handle this ATAN issue. But it may have looked like a weird operating point to you. Any questions on that? Okay. Then we'll go into content for today's lecture. So we have now finished everything that I wanted to say on this sinusoidal analysis framework. And we're going to have a little bit of discussion of where we stand today. And then the end of class or next class, we're going to move into kind of back to state plane analysis, but talking about general resonant switch circuits. What kind of modifications can we do to traditional topologies to achieve certain switching behaviors? So before we dive into that, what I want to do is just look at, to date, kind of using zero voltage switching type techniques, what have we done with our principal loss mechanisms in this converter? And we'll just use a buck converter as our example. So we'll look at comparing a traditional CCM hard switched buck converter to a zero voltage switch buck converter. So our traditional CCM would have some small ripple inductor current, the triangular wave shape that looks like this. And switch node be here as the inductor current is ramping up, be high, and it'll fall down. We're here, and back up. Kind of our ideal assumptions, it looks more or less just like a square wave. Okay. If we kind of, even with this small ripple, nearly constant inductor current waveform, go in and analyze exactly what's happening during these dead times, what we find, well, during this first dead time, when we shut off Q1 and then turn on Q2, since the inductor current is flowing out of the switch node, we have the possibility of zero voltage switching on this interval. That inductor current is going to tend to discharge the parasitic capacitance of Q2, charge up parasitic capacitance of Q1, and possibly we'll get some resonant waveform with a big filter inductor, so we see almost no delta IL, but can give us zero voltage switching of this, this transition. Problems over here on TD2, our second dead time. When we shut off the slow side device Q2, going to happen? Well, since the inductor current is the same polarity, what it's going to do is just immediately turn on the body diode of CDS2, conduct through the body diode for the entire dead time, and then at the end of the dead time, we're going to hard switch and rip that voltage up. Okay. When we go to a zero voltage switching implementation, what we're going to eventually call in the next section the ZVS quasi square wave operation. Like we saw in the introductory lecture, how do we do that? Well, we allow very large ripple on the inductor. So ripple needs to be, how did I lose that? Large enough such that we can change polarity of the inductor current during this dead time. If we do that, our switch node voltage is going to look pretty similar here. It's going to actually be a little bit faster due to the higher current. But then during the second dead time now, since the inductor current has changed polarity, we have the potential, if we design it right, to get a nice resonant transition and zero voltage turn on. So what I want to talk about here is of the different switching loss mechanisms that we've talked about, how does having this zero volt switching affect all of them? What's gone, what's left? Okay. So if we kind of run through different possible switching loss mechanisms, we've got COSS loss, I'll say COSS, as well as any C-switch, CL, CD, any sort of lumped capacitance here at the switch node, between the switch node and any DC node in the circuit. So the loss from either shorting out or hard charging these capacitances is more or less eliminated. Of course, that depends on designing and achieving these nice zero voltage switching waveforms, getting the correct dead time, making sure you can accommodate long enough dead time so that this whole transition can complete. But at least to first order, those losses are gone. Next, we have overlap and overlap at turn on and turn off of each MOSFET. So turn-on losses are more or less eliminated as well. Okay. During both of these transitions, before I turn on any FET, let's see, we got here Q1 off, here Q2 on, here Q2 off, Q1 on. Because we achieve zero voltage switching before we turn on that FET, there's already zero voltage across it. So there isn't the ability to have this terrible turn on overlap triangle. We have to keep conducting current until the voltage falls and have both voltage and current at the same time. And we turn it on, there's already zero voltage. All we're doing when we turn it on is ramping up the current that goes through the channel. And so the turn on should be completely eliminated. Turn off, on the other hand, can potentially have gotten worse. Recall for turn off, what we looked at is, okay, what is the rate of rise of the drain to source voltage? And we wanted that to be much less than IG over CGD. For example, at this transition here, TD1, we now have much higher current in the inductor. Has to be a higher peak to keep the same average when it has 100% ripple. That higher current is going to cause the switch node voltage to rise more quickly. Kind of crammed it in here, but this red waveform should drop a little bit faster, about twice as fast. It's double the peak current. So this inequality is going to be even harder to satisfy, and if we have the exact same gate driver, we probably have a little bit more residual turn-off loss. still all depends on the gate driver and if we can design a gate driver to be faster than this switch node voltage rising, then we can get rid of this turnoff overlap loss. But just comparing the two, what we had in CCM versus our soft switching case, whatever we have left for turnoff overlap loss is going to increase. See what else we talked about. Talking about reverse recovery. This is going to be approximately eliminated. If our dead time is a little long, and for example, we conduct through this high side body diode before we turn on Q1, there is going to be some kind of effect on the losses there, but even in that case, it's really not reverse recovery. We're through the opposite diode. We don't have this diode turning off with a huge voltage across it, so the losses are going to be pretty minimal there. We don't have any of this case where one diode is conducting while the other device turns on. Any remaining diode conduction is in a device that is about to turn on. We're turning on the same device that is conducting through its diode. Should have more or less gotten rid of that. What else? QG loss or P gate. Be not necessarily any change in this. This is the energy supplied by the control power supply to charge and discharge the gate of these MOSFETs. Really nothing changes there unless we go back and do something to change the gate driver as a result of these turn-off overlap losses. You can have body diode conduction during the dead time. This one, kind of tough to say, probably reduced. We look at just the waveforms I showed here, this red waveform for V-switch, it's ideal and there is no body diode conduction at all. The blue waveform during the dead time it conducts, depending on your assumptions about how fast the gate drivers are, you could set that dead time to zero in the blue case and have the same thing. In the ideal case, both of them have none. Practically, with some error in your timing, both of them may have a little bit of body diode conduction. It should be a little bit better in this case. We've got a nice slow rise here that we can time out and be a little bit closer. Then for the sake of completeness, a couple that we haven't analyzed really in detail but have talked about. Shoot through type losses, we have this Miller effect as we turn on one device causing the other device to turn on. These are things that we haven't analyzed because if you have it, your converter's in trouble, you need to get rid of it. You don't need to analyze and model that, you need to fix it. This should be ideally a little bit improved situation in that the worst switching action was here. One where we have this super high DVDT because we're hard switching, and we've changed that over to a nice slow DVDT rise. So the amount of current that'll couple back through the non-active devices CGD should be smaller, result in a smaller blip on the non-active devices gate drive. But this first transition is a little bit faster, so we may see a little bit more problem on that transition, even though it's not the limiting case. And then last one is anything due to L-pair parasitic inductance. This one I haven't put a lot of emphasis on, but if I have, for example, like some parasitic power loop inductance, how does that impact the switching behaviors of the circuit? Of any sort of common source inductance, other parasitic inductance, which aren't part of the main circuit design. And for that, it will really depend. some case it should be better since we have smaller EVDTs in the circuit. Should excite ringing with that L parrot less, but also significant parasitic inductance may deteriorate our operation and cause us to lose CVS. So, main point being, once we've achieved full soft switching, what's kind of left? So, it's turn off type overlap loss, impact of any additional parasitic inductance, perhaps some body diode conduction, maybe PG, but we're gonna leave that to the side because that comes from a different supply and has to do with gate driver design. But these are really our main remaining loss mechanisms, and going to zero voltage switching throws off kind of COSS losses, turn on overlap, reverse recovery, pushes those to the side, allows us to then push our design a little bit harder. We can go out to higher switching frequency and use smaller inductors for higher power density. But then where is that gonna end? It's just gonna push our goal a little bit further. And now our limiting loss mechanisms are gonna be these three that are remaining. It's not gonna be, we get ZVS and now we can go to a gigahertz. It's gonna be, we transition from being 100 kilohertz design to a megahertz design, and then these remaining switching losses become our limiting factors. Does that make sense? Left, and then I'm gonna speak at a high level about some of the higher frequency designs out there in literature. So ideally, if these are our remaining loss mechanisms, then if we wanna push even further, what we really wanna do is focusing here and a little bit on the parasitic inductance impact. Probably our next limiting factor is this turn-off overlap loss. And so what we really like is to keep all of this nice zero voltage switching stuff, but additionally have slow rise on the drain to source voltage of each MOSFET as it turns off. Or equivalently, we wanna have not a lot of current going through the MOSFET when it turns off. We want it in the correct polarity, but we want small magnitude so that this drain to source rises very slowly and gives us time to get the gate driver fully off. So what we really like is not just what we have here, but we'd like to do something about this peak current at TD1. Get that down as Q1 turns off so that we don't have this really sharp, fast EVDT. So in an ideal case, our ideal switching waveforms, DS and IDS for our MOSFET anywhere in the converter. As we switch, they would get a VGS here, and a VDS, we'd like to get good zero voltage switching, so we would like VDS to somehow resonate down to zero before we start to turn on this device. And then when we go to shut it off, what we'd like to have happen is the current conducting through the device has kind of dropped somehow down to a low value, so that instead of getting something where as we begin to turn off, the current starts rising, we get something where as we begin to turn off, the voltage rises very slowly. That for IDS, we'd like to have happen as it turns on, kind of somehow here ramp up the current through it, but then drop that current back down real low before we shut the device off so that we can have some slow rise and limited overlap loss on turn off. And this, obviously the way I've drawn it, kind of goes towards employing some kind of resonance additionally during the on time of the converter. I'm drawing this waveform, main characteristics and why I drew it like this. Okay, I want to get up to some average value through the time that current is going through this device, just based on the operation of the converter. It's going to have to conduct some average current to get the power through. But what I want is the current to drop before shutoff. So that I can get this nice slow DVDT rise and limit the residual turnoff overlap losses. And as we go up to converters switching in the tens of megahertz or hundreds of megahertz, this becomes more and more important, just because our gate drives can only be so fast and the residual turnoff overlap losses can become really significant at high switching frequency. Things up in the multiple tens of megahertz or hundreds of megahertz are typically more of research products than commercial designs. Generally, the breakpoint for something that is advantageous in application is in the low megahertz range. Up above that becomes more of academic interest than something that really is a good functional product that minimizes cost, efficiency, power density, maximizes power density, anything like that. So I'm going to talk real quick about things that we won't really cover in detail in this course, but just to let you know kind of where things go up at higher switching frequencies. As you go up into the tens of megahertz, power electronics starts to blend a little bit with RF design. One of the common topologies used is this one, just generally called the Class E amplifier. And that nomenclature comes from RF. We're looking at power electronics, not as input power, output power, but as a input signal coming in and an output signal going out. And so they call it an amplifier, looking at the input as the gate driver pulses. It's a Class E amplifier. It's drawn a little bit strange here, but it's got this is an AC output. This is an inverter. And I kind of flip things around. This L1 is a big filter choke that should more or less have a constant current coming from VDC. And then the setup here, it's drawn with the BJT where it left. We integrate this MOSFET here and its CDS capacitance. And then at the output, CDS capacitance should be C1 here, supplemented with some additional capacitance to control the switching waveforms. And then it's got a series resonant filter here, D2, L2, to the output. So it uses this constant DC current source as well as a kind of sinusoidal output between C2 and L2. To get zero voltage switching, but also because we have this sinusoidal output and we subtract the DC off it, we can get a nice resonant waveform going through the device when it's on. For example, here is IDS and VDS in some example design. Ends up, we're dumping current into this MOSFET with a really high peak voltage. VDS peak be about 3 times VDC. So with much higher voltage stresses on this device, what we get out of it is a nice resonant voltage transition, and then a current goes up and then drops back down before the device begins to turn on. So it can have limited residual overlap losses, obtaining ZVS of everything.
Higher peaks, isn't that going to increase our conduction losses?
So having higher peak voltage does not necessarily, it doesn't directly increase conduction losses. It will kind of in a second order mechanism increase conduction losses, in that if this was just a half bridge inverter, I could use devices rated for a third the voltage of what I would need in this Class E topology. And for the same amount of silicon area, if I have higher blocking voltage, I'm going to get a higher resistance. So it's going to kind of force us to make a decision. I'm either paying more for this FET now, or If I pay the same amount, I probably have a higher on resistance, so it'll affect my conduction losses. Generally, particularly as we'll see in some of the resonant switch stuff that we'll cover next, when we employ these large resonances, we can kind of push them one direction or the other. We can keep the RMS currents roughly the same and have much higher voltage stress, or we can keep the peak voltage the same and have higher RMS currents. Either have to use higher voltage devices or have higher conduction loss slash have to use higher current devices. The current is some half sinusoid, more or less, resonant waveform. It's going to have a little bit higher peak than what we would have had otherwise, but not so bad. The voltage takes the brunt of the additional stress. So that's the Class C amplifier, and then going further from that, something that's been getting a lot of attention or interest in the last couple of years is these variants of the Class E, Class EF, Class Phi, Class Phi 2 type topologies. This Phi 2 inverter that's been published on heavily in recent years, basically the Class E amplifier, just with an addition of a shunt third harmonic filter here. Otherwise, it operates the exact same, and that third harmonic filter, all it does is adds a third harmonic in the voltage waveform, where if I didn't have it, my waveform would look like this. Adding that third harmonic gives me this waveform, which cuts down the voltage stress a little bit. This is some reference here. This was a 30 megahertz Class Phi 2 inverter, facing 93-ish% efficiency over some range of power and input voltage. These things operate real well at very specific operating points, Class E and these variants, Class Phi 2, other of these resonant class high frequency inverters. They're difficult to control. They can only operate with all of these advantages at very specific operating points. If you start changing around the duty cycle, suddenly they lose zero volt switching, or they start to have really high turnoff overlap losses. They have to be controlled on a very specific trajectory. Most often it's a fixed load resistance that they want to operate with. Here's just another example. This takes that Class Phi 2 and makes it into a DC to DC converter instead of just an inverter by adding a resonant rectifier, using similar design. They also went and put in a kind of integrated gate drive to go up to 110 megahertz switching frequency. Gate drive is this self-oscillating. They put in some resonant components so that once it starts up, gets some kick, the gate drive oscillates off the main power waveforms in order to keep providing pulses and let it run completely unregulated as this self-oscillating gate driver. But 110 megahertz, all the inductors are these air core toroids up here. They have to be designed to limit the high frequency losses. So they're kind of in the PCB toroidal inductors with thin solid copper windings. Keep the skin effect losses and additional core losses from negatively impacting the efficiency. So we're not going to go into any additional detail on Class E and all these things, but I just kind of wanted to mention, if we keep pushing in this direction, here's kind of how things go in the literature currently. Here's how we can keep going up to higher and higher frequency. Hundreds of megahertz is about as high as anybody has showcased something that is of a reasonable efficiency. A couple hundred megahertz, anything higher than that has been 30% efficient, 20% efficient, for the most part. Okay. Any other questions on any of this?
What would it take for these to enter the practical realm?
There's a few things here. One, like with this, you see it's got this self-oscillating gate drive. Gate drive losses become very significant at 110 megahertz. They are, at some point, you lose kind of the advantage of control that we've talked about with high switching frequency converters. They can't be controlled in a traditional, using traditional approaches. So most of these like 100 megahertz converters are controlled, if at all, using on-off control, burst mode. So to regulate the output, you just turn it on, turn it off at some lower duty cycle, which means your control bandwidth is going to be dictated by that lower frequency turn on, turn off, and then you lose all of these sorts of control advantages. So eventually there becomes a question of why are you doing this, right? It's not giving you higher control bandwidth. Also, your magnetics start to get larger as you have to go to air cores rather than like a ferrite core inductor where you get a high inductance in a smaller volume due to that high permeability. Air cores, we need just bigger area to get higher inductance. So at the moment, they're probably not so practical for general purpose applications until we can get really good 100 megahertz and above low loss magnetic materials and switches that are good enough to allow some of these residual turnoff losses so that we can control them using duty cycle, phase shift, anything like that, and not have to on-off control them because they only want to operate at very specific operating points. Things still can be very useful in certain applications where maybe you can't use a cored inductor. It's example in some high external magnetic field. Got some interest in things like space applications or scientific applications in an MRI machine, something else where there may be high magnetic field around that would saturate a cored inductor if you had one. But there are a few different advancements needed for these things to really be competitive on a application-oriented evaluation.
Thank you.
That being said, lest this recording leak out, I think these things are super interesting and it's good research work. Once I've got specific papers referenced here, I don't want to come off as saying these things are impractical and silly. It's good work researching, seeing how far we can push things, and we learn a lot from that. Other questions, and we'll just begin to start the next section here. I'm going to cover what is talked about in chapter 20 of, again, the second edition of Fundamentals of Power Electronics. Again, this book is not required. It's recommended and convenient to have, but it's not required for the course. There won't be anything in that chapter that I don't cover that you'll need to know. It's, I think, chapter 22 or 23 in the third edition. I didn't look that up beforehand. But what it talks about is they call these resonant switch topologies or really circuits. And the idea is to try to treat the achievement of soft switching generally within the context of a parent PWM converter. The idea is we're going to look at things like a buck, a boost, a buck boost, Chooks, EPIC, traditional two-switch PWM topologies, and see, can we talk generally about the modifications we would make to achieve zero voltage switching or zero current switching? And it turns out you can by looking at what they call the switch cell, which, so this here is a buck converter where they pulled the switches out separately, MOSFET and diode over here, and look at how we can modify that switch cell. And if we understand the behavior of just this switch cell operating in some soft switching resonant manner, we can plug that back into any of these two switch PWM topologies and have now a converter that is a CHUKE but achieve zero voltage switching, or is a CEPIC but achieve zero current switching. And what we're going to look at is the switch cell as this equivalent circuit here with some, I lost a active switch Q and some passive switch D. Applies whether I do a synchronous implementation and make them both MOSFETs or whether I have a MOSFET and a diode. General idea is there's one switch which is actively switched. It's our transistor type device, single quadrant, but the upper right quadrant, and then one device that is can be a passive switch, even if we implement it as a transistor, as a synchronous rectifier. And this switch cell we're looking at is the high frequency view of the switching network. It turns out that for any of these topologies, they'll reduce to the same switch cell. For example, if I take my buck converter with an input voltage VG, some output filter cap, Cout, and a load resistance, and then look at the high frequency behavior of this converter. At high frequency, my inductor becomes an open, my input voltage source becomes a short, and what I end up with is just these two switches effectively in parallel. I take a boost converter at high frequency, my inductor becomes an open, my output capacitor will become a short, very high frequency, and I end up with just these two switches in parallel. Buck boost, my input voltage and my output capacitor become shorts at high frequency, my inductor is an open. Hold this around, I end up with this same circuit. Like a CHUKE, my capacitor becomes a short, two inductors become an open, and I end up with the same thing. So in all of these at high frequency, it just looks like a couple of switches in parallel. So then we can look at, okay, what sort of behaviors are we getting out of this switch cell for a certain type of switching, regardless of the converter topology. So we're going to look at four different switch setups. They're going to be zero voltage switching and zero current switching, and then quasi-square wave and what's called quasi-resonant. We'll start with this one because it's the one we've looked at in the past, zero voltage switching, quasi-square wave type switch cell. The one like we looked at in the introductory lecture, we started by taking a boost converter and letting it go into DCM and then making it synchronous. So just allowing this big inductor current ripple so that we get zero voltage switching. The high frequency view of that was that we took this inductor LF and made it smaller, made it a resonant element instead of a big filter element. So then when we look at high frequency, we're going to keep that in there because it's no longer some DC filter element that we can just assume is a current source. Now it's actually resonant. And we had it resonate with CDS, and in this case also the diode capacitance and any other additional capacitance from the switch node to ground. We look at the high frequency behavior of that. The input is a short, the output filter capacitor is a short. And what we end up with in our high frequency circuit is some resonant inductor and some resonant capacitance, both in parallel with our two switches. For boost converter, you get the exact same thing. LR, and we take the net switch node capacitance to ground, short out the input, short out the output. We've got an input source at the input, some big filter capacitor at the output, both look like shorts to any high frequency, and get this same network. We did a buck boost. We'd again let this, what was a filter inductor in our buck boost, become a resonant inductor. Incorporate capacitance from both of these devices into our resonant scheme. The input still a fixed DC voltage source. The output should be DC with the filter capacitor. Get the same thing as we reduce that, even in the CHUKE down here. What we would do is either or both of these inductors would become resonant elements. Actually just do one or the other or both of them. We'll let them become resonant. Our filter, our the isolation capacitor and the chuke, the C in the middle, will still remain a filter element. So that still is a short at high frequency. And our input source and our output cap from shorts. And then whether I have one or both of these inductors, we still end up with this kind of circuit. High frequency, all of these things where we let large ripple in the inductor soft switch the capacitance of our devices become this type of circuit here. And so we can look just generally at this type of circuit to see how waveforms are going to evolve in any of these topologies. Then everything else other than the waveforms of the switch network is just going to stay however it was in the CCM small ripple parent topology. Solve the waveforms of the switch network according to state plane analysis, and then we can just plug that into, for a buck boost, overall behavior is D over D prime conversion ratio. Everything else just behaves as it would in a traditional topology. So that's one type of resonant network, the zero voltage switching quasi square wave. There are four that we'll talk about. We'll pick up there on Wednesday. Thank you, everyone.